Today is Wednesday, September 26th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump uses his speech at the UN General Assembly to issue warnings about Iran.
Iran's leaders sow chaos, death, and destruction.
The U.S. imposes fresh sanctions on Venezuela as that country dives deeper into chaos. Comedian Bill Cosby is sentenced to prison for a sexual assault conviction.
May God forgive you, because in my being a human being, I know I never can, and I never will.
American soldiers seeking help in reuniting with dogs they've bonded in war zones. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, President Donald Trump poured scorn on the ideology of globalism and heaped praise on his own administration's achievements Tuesday in a speech to the UN General Assembly. The comments drew head shakes and even mocking laughter from his audience of fellow world leaders.
In less than 2 years, my administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. America's so true. Didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay.
The spontaneous response to Trump's address only reinforced the view of some of the American president's isolation among allies and foes alike, as his nationalistic policies have created rifts with erstwhile partners and cast doubt in some circles about the reliability of American commitments around the world. Trump also flaunted his embrace of negotiations with North Korea's Kim Jong-un just a year after he had warned of raining down total destruction on a leader he branded Little Rocket Man.
I would like to thank Chairman Kim for his courage and for the steps he has taken, though much work remains to be done. The sanctions will stay in place until denuclearization occurs.
As Trump praised Kim's courage Tuesday, he unloaded harsh rhetoric on nuclear-aspiring Iran as a persistent malign influence across the Middle East.
We cannot allow the world's leading sponsor of terrorism to possess the planet's most dangerous weapons. We cannot allow a regime that chants death to America and that threatens Israel with annihilation to possess the means to deliver a nuclear warhead to any city on Earth.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said that U.S. policy toward Iran has been wrong from the beginning, and its approach of resisting the wishes of the Iranian people is doomed to failure. Trump said his administration has started last month reimposing nuclear sanctions that had been lifted under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and would be more would be imposed on November 5th and beyond. Trump called on world leaders to isolate Iran's regime as long as its aggression continues. In International Edition, Sarah Williams spoke with VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir about the president's speech.
We knew he would speak about Iran, but actually he wasn't as tough or strong or threatening on Iran as many expected him to be. So I think it was a pretty calm speech for him compared to last year, and he covered a lot of themes, including this issue of national sovereignty. And he said, the United States will not tell you how to work or live or worship, and we ask that you honor our sovereignty in return.
He said the United States is interested in countries that have the best interests at heart, that the United States wants to help its friends.
Right, and he was talking specifically about foreign assistance. And we've heard this for several weeks now, that the State Department's going to undertake a review of U.S. foreign aid. And we've heard it from Ambassador Haley here at the United Nations. I think we've heard it from Mike Pompeo as well, that we're going to give our aid dollars where countries have similar interests to the United States and treat the United States well. And he basically said that today. And he said, we're going to see whether these countries have our interests at heart. And we're only going to give aid to those countries that respect us and are our friends. So he was quite clear about it, this being sort of the U.S.'s new foreign aid policy.
So is that quite a switch from what has existed in previous administrations?
It is. And it sort of makes foreign assistance, not about humanitarianism or other national security interests, but makes it much more transactional.
Trump also spoke about how he wants other countries to pay their fair share, and I believe that's to do with UN peacekeeping troops.
True, and that's, you know, again, not a new theme for him. We've heard it at NATO. We've heard it in other places. He said the United States will not pay more than 25% of the UN peacekeeping budget. And in fact, that's how much the U.S. is supposed to pay. It's crept up over the last decade or so to about 28%. But it's, and last year, Nikki Haley sort of worked with the committee that funds peacekeeping, and they brought it back down. So the U.S. has diminished its contribution to peacekeeping by several hundred million dollars, in fact, but it's really within where it's supposed to be.
Earlier, you mentioned President Trump speaking about North Korea. He seemed almost complimentary about North Korea in his speech today.
Yes, he said he thanked Chairman Kim for the courage and the steps he's taken, although he said much work has to be done, and he added that sanctions will stay in place until denuclearization happens. He said that much has gone on, you know, more than people realize, and that he thanked the countries who've helped, you know, China, South Korea, Japan. He said that they're critical support. They need critical support going forward.
He also talked about Chinese tariffs, and he said he has personal respect for President Xi Jinping, but he talked about, he said that the trade imbalance with China and I guess with other countries is not acceptable.
Right, and he said he wouldn't tolerate it. That was his word, tolerate. We won't tolerate it. And he said this trade imbalance is not acceptable. And he did single out the Chinese. He said after they joined the World Trade Organization, the United States lost over 3 million manufacturing jobs, nearly a quarter of all steel jobs, and 60,000 factories in the United States closed after China joined the WTO. So he said, you know, we won't let our workers be abused and our wealth be plundered. And I think part of that, don't forget, we're moving into the midterm election season in the United States. And I think that's as much a message to China as it is to his base voters, that I'm here for you, I'm protecting you.
He also talked about energy, you know, oil production, and he said that OPEC is ripping off the world.
Yeah, that actually really surprised me because a lot of the OPEC countries are his best friends. So I was sort of surprised he went after them. But he said, I don't like it and nobody should. And we defend many of these nations for nothing and then they take advantage of us. Not good. So I guess he's getting ready to have a conversation with some of his friends in OPEC. He also took a swipe at the Germans, surprisingly, saying that they'd become totally dependent on Russian energy if they don't immediately change course. And at that moment, the TV cameras panned over to the German delegation, and the foreign minister and the ambassador here, who used to be Angela Merkel's national security advisor, were both sort of giggling at the table when he mentioned Germany. So I don't know how upset they were about it. I think there's one thing I'd like to mention, though, which stood out to me as one of the most important things that he said in the speech that may not get the headlines, but it's a tremendous blow to international accountability and justice. He mentioned the International Criminal Court, and the United States is not a signatory to the court, but it has never stood in its way in prosecuting dictators and warlords and people who've committed atrocities, including genocide and crimes against humanity. And today he said that the ICC has no jurisdiction or legitimacy or authority. And I think that's going to be a tremendous blow to the court. It could even be the beginning of the end of the court, because if the United States is not backing the court, it's going to be very hard. I mean, it was great news to Bashar al-Assad and to the military in Myanmar and to dictators and bad guys around the world today when he said that.
Mm-hmm. Although I think former President George W. Bush was also very critical of the court.
He was critical of the court. He did not obstruct the court, though. The problem is that the ICC prosecutor has been looking at the behavior of U.S. troops in Afghanistan, and this has spurred this sort of stiffening of the U.S. spine against the court. And John Bolton, who's the president's national security advisor, has never been a fan of the International Criminal Court. And so I think one can see his hand in this.
That's VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir. Well, meanwhile, China said Tuesday it's impossible to hold trade talks with the United States with a new round of tariffs in place. The U.S. imposed duties on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods and a retaliatory set of tariffs imposed by Beijing on $60 billion worth of U.S. goods that took effect on Monday. Chinese Vice Commerce Minister Wang Xiwen asked reporters in Beijing Tuesday how any talks proceed now that the Trump administration has adopted such, quote, large-scale restrictions, which he said is like, quote, holding a knife to someone's throat. The new U.S. duties cover thousands of Chinese-made products, including electronics, food, tools, and housewares. The new tariffs begin at 10%, then will rise to 25% on January 1st, 2019. Trump scolded China at the UN General Assembly Tuesday.
I have great respect and affection for my friend, President Xi, but I have made clear our trade imbalance is just not acceptable. China's market distortions and the way they deal cannot be tolerated.
Meanwhile, China says it's filed an official protest over plans by the United States to sell military equipment to Taiwan. Its foreign ministry spokesman said Tuesday that Washington's plan to sell Taipei $330 million in spare parts for the F-16 fighter jet, the C-130 cargo plane, and other military aircraft violates international laws. Beijing is demanding the Trump administration cancel the deal, saying it will damage bilateral ties, peace, and stability in the Taiwan Strait and China's cooperation in other issues. Taiwan's presidential office thanked the U.S. for the deal in a statement vowing to, quote, maintain close communication and cooperation with Washington on security issues. And you're listening to International Edition on VOA. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A memo shows separating families was U.S. government policy. At the UN, Congo's Kabila vows peaceful and credible elections. Four EU countries reach a deal to end limbo of rescued migrants. And a U.S. general says suspected drills on the Korean Peninsula caused military degradation. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, on Tuesday, also at the UN, President Trump called for a restoration of democracy, stepping up financial pressure by slapping socialist president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro's inner circle with fresh sanctions.
We ask the nations gathered here to join us in calling for the restoration of democracy in Venezuela.
Trump declined to respond to questions about whether U.S.-led military intervention in the crisis-stricken country was possible, saying he doesn't reveal military strategy. The Trump administration slapped additional financial sanctions on four members of Maduro's inner circle, including his wife and the nation's vice president, on allegations of corruption. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke about the situation with Jeff Ramsey, Venezuela analyst with the Washington Office of Latin America.
The sanctions themselves are not particularly grave in terms of the magnitude, in terms of the effect they're actually going to have on the targeted officials. Last Friday, Secretary Pompeo said something to the effect that, the U.S. is going to roll out new and strong measures against the Venezuelan government. And we were expecting something more along the lines of sanctions against the oil sector. Instead, what we've seen are sanctions against four individuals within Maduro's ruling circle that freezes their assets and denies them visas. So, I think it's important symbolically, but it's not particularly that much beyond the existing targeted sanctions that we've seen against some 70 other people in the Venezuelan government.
President Trump's call for a restoration of democracy in Venezuela, is that code for perhaps an overthrow?
Well, I think it's interesting. The sanctions that were announced were against some of the main power brokers in Maduro's inner circle. And I think the logic that we've heard from people in State Department and elsewhere in government for not sanctioning these individuals is that if there's going to be some kind of split within the Venezuelan government, there will have to be some kind of fissure between these individuals and Maduro. And I think by sanctioning them all, the Trump administration has essentially given up on this kind of internal split within Maduro's inner circle. Instead, I think what we're seeing is that this administration believes that in order for some kind of break within the government to occur, there needs to be something more along the lines of a horizontal split. So something that pits more lower-ranking individuals within the government against elites, something along the lines of a military coup. And I do believe that that is essentially this administration's theory of change on Venezuela. But I do believe that people in the Trump administration have to account for the fact that, you know, we've seen various coup attempts so far over the last year. All of them have failed.
Do you see any schism at all within the government in any sector in Venezuela?
Well, you know, not yet. But we do know that the financial sanctions, the sanctions that are complicating the Venezuelan government's ability to restructure its debt, those sanctions are having a huge impact. And they're cutting into the ruling elite's ability to enjoy their ill-gotten gains. And I think we're likely to see more struggles within the ruling party in the coming weeks and months. So I don't think we've seen a meaningful split within the ruling party yet, but I am hopeful that we'll see one in the future.
Several Latin American nations are planning to present a complaint against Mr. Maduro's government for alleged rights abuses with the International Criminal Court. Will that go anywhere?
You know, I think the International Criminal Court, it's an important process, but it is also a painstakingly slow one. The government of Colombia has been the subject of a preliminary investigation by the prosecutor of the ICC for several years now. So, you know, I think it's an important step because it's the first time that, you know, the five countries will have gotten together and encouraged the prosecutor to investigate the accusations of crimes against humanity in another state. But again, you know, I don't think we're going to see any instant results there.
Mr. Maduro said he's a victim of an economic war led by U.S.-backed adversaries, and he said he's open to arranging a face-to-face meeting with Mr. Trump. How likely is that?
Well, I think it's actually not as unlikely as you would think. I mean, you know, I think this president prides himself on being a master dealmaker. He's already proven that he's willing to meet with Kim Jong-un. And I do think that if the time were right and if the Trump administration were to be convinced that meaningful concessions would be made by the Venezuelans, one could make the argument for such a meeting to occur. However, I don't think that the Maduro government is there yet, and they have yet to show that they'd be open to any kind of meaningful return to democracy in Venezuela.
That's Jeff Ramsey, Venezuela analyst with the Washington office on Latin America. Well, the U.S. Senate's partisan brawl over President Donald Trump's embattled Supreme Court nominee intensified Tuesday, fewer than 48 hours before Judge Brett Kavanaugh, one of his accusers, is expected to give testimony on whether the nominee committed sexual assault as a teenager. Christine Blasey Ford has accused Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her at a high school party in the 1980s, a charge the nominee has repeatedly denied. Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky accused Democrats of rushing to convict Kavanaugh and destroying his good name with unproven allegations and abandoning any presumption of innocence, a bedrock principle of American jurisprudence.
We want this hearing to be handled very professionally, not a political sideshow like you saw the put on by the Democrats when they were questioning Judge Kavanaugh.
Senate Democrats, though, countering that, saying if Republicans wanted to learn the facts about the nominee's past behavior, they wouldn't have rejected calls for an investigation of the allegations against him. Minority Leader Chuck Schumer also accused Republicans of treating Ford dismissively at a time when victims of sexual crimes are speaking out across the nation.
The fact that our Republican friends are busy pointing fingers, calling names, and despicably saying what Dr. Ford did is a smear job shows that they're afraid of the facts.
The sharp exchanges on the Senate floor came one day after Kavanaugh appeared on U.S. cable television, an unprecedented move for a Supreme Court nominee to refute all allegations of sexual misconduct. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. win prizes, and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. 81-year-old Bill Cosby was marched out of court with his hands and feet shackled on Tuesday after a judge branded him a predator and sentenced him to between 3 and 10 years in prison for sexual assault. It capped the downfall of the once-beloved comedian known as America's Dad. Montgomery County Court of Common Pleas Judge Stephen O'Neill ordered Cosby to be jailed immediately, denying Cosby's request for bail while lawyers appealed the conviction. The woman's attorney, Gloria Allred, spoke to reporters after the sentencing.
Even though he has no prior criminal history, even though he's 81 years old, even though he's legally blind, as the court pointed out, no one's above the law. It's equal justice. It doesn't matter who Mr. Cosby is or was. He committed the crime. He has to do the time.
Cosby was found guilty in April of 3 counts of aggravated indecent assault for the drugging and sexually assaulting of his one-time friend, Andrea Constand, a former Temple University administrator at his Philadelphia home, in 2004. Cosby spokesman Andrew Wyatt said he was a subject of the most racist and sexist trial in the history of the United States.
He knows that these are lies. They persecuted Jesus, and look what happened. Not saying Mr. Cosby's Jesus, but we know what this country has done to black men for centuries.
More than 60 other women have also accused Cosby of sexual abuse, going back decades, with most too old to prosecute. The Constrand case is the only allegation that has resulted in conviction. She left the court with her arms folded, a smile spreading across her face as other women who've accused Cosby came to hug her. Several of those women, including Sunny Wells, spoke to reporters in the rain outside the courtroom.
I sincerely hope that you suffer now. I cannot forgive. Right now, not now. Because you deserve to feel in every moment for the rest of your life what the 63 of us women felt.
Cosby is the first celebrity to be convicted of sexual abuse since the start of the, quote, hashtag MeToo movement, the national reckoning with misconduct that has brought down dozens of powerful men in entertainment, politics, and other fields. Cosby must spend at least 3 years in a Pennsylvania prison before he becomes eligible for supervised release, though he could end up behind bars for up to a decade. In a written victim impact statement given to the court, Constand said the attack had turned her into a woman who was, quote, stuck in a holding pattern for most of her adult life, unable to heal fully or to move forward. She wrote, Bill Cosby took my beautiful, healthy young spirit and crushed it. American soldiers stationed in war zones often find comfort in stray dogs they meet. They're considered man's best friend by Americans, but they're not so much regarded as pets in many parts of the Middle East. The animal rescue group, the Guardians of Rescue, works to reunite soldiers with the dogs they've become companions and bonded with as wartime companions, as they have to return back to the United States. In this latest effort, the group is raising money to help relocate one such pup back to the U.S. U.S. Army Specialist Joseph Gomez was upset to have to leave without his dog that he named Hilal, who was injured and left for dead when he found him. Gomez says he can't bear the thought of leaving behind the dog that he formed a bond with and who would face certain death. Joining us now for more on this effort to reunite the two is Guardians of Rescue President Robert Missouri.
One of the biggest challenges that we have when we have to rescue one of these dogs, the majority of the locals do do not respect dogs. In fact, they think they're unholy and dirty, and children at a very young age are, believe it or not, encouraged to hurt them. It is extremely common for someone to walk up to a dog in the street if they can grab him and just cut their ears off. It's a very, very, very common practice.
Where are you referring to? I mean, Middle East is a big place. Are we talking about specific countries or just as a whole in that part of the world?
Afghanistan is one of them. Jordan, Syria. In fact, Jordan right now it's a staged hub for us where we're getting a lot of the dogs out of. And they actually have a holy war going on with a lot of the people, where a religious leader about a year and a half ago went public and said to kill every dog you see because a dog bit a young child. Dogs run stray in the streets there. There are no veterinary clinics. So they live on the streets. They survive on whatever they can. Their lifespans are very short. But more important, they are not protected. They have no protection. So when we do get a phone call from a family member or an email that their loved one is overseas,
mm-hmm.
and they rescued this puppy and he was in dire straits, starving or whatever it may be, and now he has to come back to the States.
Right.
He's panicking because it's a very powerful bond because they're both in an area where they can easily be killed. It is a stressful environment. You hear gunfire and explosions, and the stress level is through the roof. So they get a very strong bond, and the service members that we have spoken to that never had the opportunity to bring back the dog that they had that bond with, it weighs very, very heavy on them, mm. on them for the rest of their lives.
I understand there's one person in particular that has a pretty dramatic story, Army Specialist Joseph Gomez.
He is actually somebody who, he's our latest project. He was in a very specialized area. We had to get his puppy out of a specialized area into another country. And he is currently living in Oklahoma when he returns with his wife and their newborn. And they bonded. He saved this puppy. No question that this puppy would have been killed. And unfortunately, these details that we cannot share about the circumstances around how he found the dog, he just can't share them. They're kind of sensitive. But the dog is safe once he got him. The biggest problem, challenge for us, is we can't raise the money. We cannot raise the money to get these dogs back. And we keep getting more and more requests, but we're having a hard time raising the funds to get these pups back.
They're not able to somehow, through the military, get assistance to bring them back?
It does not exist. In fact, it is frowned upon to even have a stray dog in their camps. So they can't leave with them. They can't do anything. So they have to depend on people who, like us, organizations like us, and who we use as retired military. But when they go into these areas, they are now civilians. They can't wear armor. They can't have a firearm. And they're going in to collect these dogs and get them to safety. But it all costs money. And I'm very, very disappointed in the response, this last one with Joe Gomez, in the money that's not being raised. I guess they don't understand the value of the soldier and the animal and what would happen if this dog was left behind.
How costly is it?
It averages about $5,000 to bring a dog back.
Where is the dog now?
The dog is in Jordan, being cared for now.
Mm-hmm.
Secretly, it's not like you could just put him in your yard. If anybody knew that that dog was being cared for a soldier, that person would probably be killed. The bad people obviously found out. So it's a little more complicated than people think.
So is Mr. Gomez is now back in the United States, still working?
He's still active serving. He separated from the dog very recently, and the dog is waiting to be transported to another location where we can keep the dog safe and then ultimately flown to New York.
What is your ultimate hope here? Do you believe this dog will ultimately be reunited and brought back home with Mr. Gomez?
We have never failed a service member. No matter what, we have to do it. We will do it. Once the pup is in New York, it'll go through another series of vetting and what have you. Then we'll fly him to Oklahoma.
What kind of condition was the dog in when he first got him?
Not good. Starving, full of fleas, and just not in a good way. They have medics. Obviously, they don't have veterinarians. They have medics that do everything they can to treat. So if it's an open wound, they'll have antibiotics.
How many soldiers have you helped, and how many requests do you usually get?
we brought back, I'm going to say, somewhere around 65 to 75 dogs. In the last 6 months, we have been getting a lot of requests. We have 4 requests right now, currently, from the same area. We just reunited 2 airmen in Texas 2 weeks ago, and we brought their dogs back, and they were ecstatic.
Thanks for joining us on International Edition. That does it for today's show. You can check us out online at voanews.com. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.